Welcome, welcome, curious souls, to the Macabre Emporium, your sanctuary for the unusual, the mysterious, and the appalling.
Step through our cryptic doorway into a world where secrets whisper and enigmas come to life.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah.
Together, we're your custodians of the macabre, guiding you through tales that defy the ordinary.
Discover the untold stories, from lesser-known cases of true crime to the bizarre events that captivate us.
Join us on a journey to the shadows where the mainstream fades and the extraordinary beckons.
So whether you seek the bizarre, the eerie, or the chillingly obscure,
you're in for a treat here at Macabre Emporium.
Welcome back to Macabre Emporium. This is episode 61.
And if this is your first time joining us because of word of mouth, Twitch, or some other random dark corner of the internet, welcome.
Welcome.
So, yeah, as you guys may have seen in the Facebook group, we had taken off the rest of the month of April because we had a couple of things lined up that we weren't going to have time to get episodes, you know,
written and recorded.
All that good fun stuff. So here we are, back in May. Mayday.
May 1st, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're the Justin Timberlakes all over the world. Yep. Super happy.
So all the Justin Timberlakes are like, it's gonna be May.
But now they can't do that because it is May.
Yep. So now it's gonna be whatever random.
We have to wait till next year.
Yep. So, or we just have to wait until I wake up everyone up when September ends.
Oh, yeah.
So, first thing that Sarah and I had went and gotten and done was the Edgar Allan Poe speakeasy that she kindly reminded everybody to harass me about.
And yet nobody did but your sister.
Yep. I'm sure Lindsay did at some point, too.
For shame.
And I really, really dropped the ball on that one, but, well, I didn't drop the ball, so to speak. We still went. In between when she put that call to action out there and the time they got the tickets, it showed up at the Bell Mansion and I didn't get tickets fast enough for it.
Yep.
And then come to find out, they had a paranormal event happen. Like, what was it? I don't remember what the video titled as. Before, during, or after when the signage fell over?
I don't know. It didn't say.
But anyhow, they caught an apparition of some sorts messing with signage for...
Knocking something off a table, yeah.
So, if you're hearing this, we're going to highly recommend you go to the Edgar Allan Poe Speakeasy if it's in your area at the time or coming close to it.
Tickets are a little steep, but it's worth it.
Yep.
The people narrating the stories did a fantastic job. The drinks were amazing, except for that last one. I don't know what the fuck they did.
I don't remember.
But the second one, the cat's meow, that shit was delicious. Mm-hmm. I could have drank that all night long.
Right, I think we all could have, because I think, other than me, because I was, you know, us driving, I don't think anybody had an empty cup of the cat's meow.
No, it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So the first drink we ended up having was...
The Pale Blue Eye.
Right.
Which was blueberry-infused vodka, fresh lemon juice, and one solo little blueberry on top.
And they did a... storytelling of
the Telltale Heart.
Yep, which was probably my favorite one out of the four we heard.
Yeah, well, it was good.
She, the lady that did that, she did a really, really good job with that one. I mean,
she did.
Even though one of their storytellers was not there, they had to, you know, had someone fill in. They all did a great job for the stories that they did tell. And so then after that, we went on to a telling of the Black Cat.
Yep,
and which. The drink that was paired with that was the cat's meow that Sarah mentioned.
Yes. And that was brandy, maple bourbon, vanilla milk, simple sugar, vanilla extract, and garnished with grated cinnamon.
Yeah. It's like I had a hard time not wanting to finish that knowing we still had a bit of a drive we had to do afterwards.
It was so good.
Mm-hmm.
If I knew the proportions for each,
right,
I would make that shit at home.
Right. And they said this was a adaptation of Poe's favorite drink.
Mm-hmm.
And what his favorite drink of choice was actually eggnog with brandy.
Well, this says we pay homage to Poe's taste for brandy with this classic milk punch.
Right. But out of my curiosity to see what his actual favorite drink was, as I looked it up and they said it was brandy, eggnog with brandy.
Correct.
Is what I found. So then from the Black Cat, we went on to, you know, the most famous one of them all. The Raven.
The Raven, yep. And the drink for that one was called Nevermore. And that was notes of peach surround our vodka foundational cocktail, finished with a dash of fresh lime juice, garnished with a slice of decayed citrus.
AKA a dry orange slice.
Yep.
And then from that one, and I don't think a whole lot of people around us really liked that from what I could hear.
I had a hard time with it because I had peach in it. And
right.
I fucking hate peach.
I know you hate peach.
But the more I drank it,
right,
the tipsier I got and the less I cared.
Yep. So. The guy that was sitting next to me that got super chatty with us in between each, you know, story, happened to notice he was double fisting it because his wife didn't care for it.
Yeah.
And then for our last story, it was The Mask of the Red Death, which I had never heard of that one. I mean, there's a lot of short mm-hmm. stories and poems he's written that I've never heard of.
Yep.
But that one was actually pretty good.
Yes.
But we had a little bit of, I had a hard time hearing that one a little bit because of the Taylor Swift bleed over from the spring formal dance that was being held over in the next room.
Yeah, that was kind of balls, but.
Right.
The drink for that one was the Cocktail of Red Death, and that was a vodka foundation, fresh watermelon juice, finished with aromatic rose petals. And let me tell you, sucking down a hard-ass rose petal chunk, not great.
I think that's why they gave everybody a straw for that one, to try and avoid that from happening.
It happened in my straw.
So you had the one in a million chance of happening that it was already in your straw.
Or they crushed the rose petals too small.
That too.
But yeah, I did not like that one. I think I took...
It was all right for me.
2-3 sips and I was done.
Yeah.
I couldn't. And that one also had... They said there was something else in it that I don't like. Guava.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Fuck that. Tastes like the way cat spray smells.
I don't think I've ever heard that referred to guava before in a way until now.
Well, it's nasty. It's one of those things, you either like it or you hate it, and I don't like it at all.
So from there, our next thing that we had planned, which we just came back from the day of us recording this episode, was going to the Michigan Horror Museum, right? Is the name of
it? Michigan Museum of Horror.
Yep. Either way, it's in Monroe, Michigan, and we met up with one of our listeners, Tyler, there. He invited us to come up there and meet him with it. Meet him up there and go see that.
Yes.
So that was interesting in itself.
Yeah.
But they had a lot of human skulls on display. They had some...
I got to hold one.
Yeah, we both got to hold a real human skull. It was a
Victorian female skull.
Yep.
That was super cool.
They had quite a few props from different horror movies. Like, they had on some worn clothing from The Walking Dead, a coat from one of the Scooby-Doo movies, various prop pieces from all sorts of movies. Like, there was a prop piece from the Saw movie was in there.
Oh, how the fuck did I miss that?
It was behind the long eyelashed Freddy Krueger mannequin in the cabinet.
Oh.
So upstairs, when you went to the right and looked at the little shrine that was there that people left offerings for, if you had turned around like 180 degrees and saw the two cabinets on the wall, it was in there.
Oh, what was it though?
It was supposed to be a pipe from the first Saw movie, I think the plaque said. I don't remember. It's not very big. It's, you know, it's a fun little thing to do on an afternoon to go there.
Yeah.
And they also had some true crime memorabilia there. They had a handwritten letter from Richard Ramirez on display.
A handwritten something. I didn't quite
read it. In the little case that's been around. That was a
Charles Manson's handwriting. Yeah, it was a
handwritten note from Charles Manson on both sides.
Yeah.
And speaking of Edgar Allan Poe, again, they had a complete 1908 collection, Raven collection of all of his short stories and poems in one setting.
Yeah. They also had, which I was super excited to see, was the death masks of Boris Karloff and Vincent Price and Bela Lugosi.
When we first got there and I saw the room that was like 18 plus only, I'm like, what's going on in there? Because usually when you see a curtain in 18 plus only, there's some spicy stuff going on behind that curtain. Well, kind of, but not really. It was supposed to be like a mock-up of what they call the serial killer's like photo development room.
Uh-huh.
And they had like copies of legitimate crime scene photos on the walls in there.
Some of them were quite interesting.
Yeah. It was like there was a couple of, you know, copies of Jeffrey Dahmer ones in there. There was ones from Jack the Ripper. Like, yeah, I kind of had to look to see who they were listing on the wall because the way they had it written on there. Yeah. Like, they had stuff from the Zodiac in there.
They had the picture of Marilyn Monroe.
Yep.
Laying face down on her bed.
Yeah, there was a lot of pictures in there. We didn't look at all of them.
No.
We could have spent, it was a very small room getting very warm with three people in there.
Yes.
But the interesting thing is the curtain that they used that none of us realized until we came out was they used an actual body bag as the curtain to get into that room.
And having to move that to the side to walk in, those are heavier than I figured they would be.
Right.
Damn.
Well, you got to think it's, you know, you're putting a biological hazard in there, so it's got to be pretty tough to not be torn open.
That's
so
true. I didn't think it was like leather almost.
No. I think it was more like a heavy pleather, not pleather, but vinyl bag.
Yeah.
It's, well, only, it's the only second time in my life.
It was heavy.
Yeah. It's only the second time in my life I've ever seen or handled one. First time it was actually being used for its intended purpose. But anyway, so what do you have for this week, Sarah?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Yeah. Nope. Not a thing.
Guess she dropped the ball and got stuck in the Diablo hole.
I didn't drop the ball. I know, we discussed this beforehand.
I'm just kidding. But since she put a call to action out to you guys almost a month ago, I'm putting one out to you guys. You guys need to harass her to return to Wednesday night co-op games with Noodle and I.
Oh.
Oh.
That means I have to climb out of the Diablo hole.
Yep.
I can do that.
I'm sure you could.
I don't need a call to action.
Yep, because a couple of them that come in regularly, they have been asking about, where's Sarah?
Who dat? Those my all hail?
Yep.
My all hail ladies?
The all hail ladies have been asking about you.
I'll be back. I'll make sure that Wednesday nights are free.
All right.
Mark my words.
All right. You heard her say it.
Word.
Word.
Free.
Yep. So since she has no story this week, I have a story this week. I'm covering true crime.
You're taking my place. Yep.
Only for this week because you don't have anything started.
I actually do.
Oh, yeah?
It's halfway done.
This is kind of, I guess you could say, a well-knownish story, but, you know, for some, but this guy is considered the father of mass murder.
Ooh, the father of mass murder.
Yep, mass murder, spree killer, active shooter, maybe.
So he's a masshole, you say?
Yeah, you could say he's a masshole. But not from Massachusetts, though. But he's from that direction. I'm going to be telling Sarah about Howard Unruh, or Unruh, depending on where you have used a resource and whatnot, which is odd because I listened to two books from the same author. That actually, I own one of the books from him, from Harold Shetner. I listened to his audiobook about it, and he said Unruh on that. And then the one that I'm currently starting, the one that's like 14 hours in length to listen to the entire thing.
Yeah.
He's mentioned in the first part of it, but it was Unruh.
By the same author?
Yes. So I don't know which book came first, though.
But is it him narrating it?
It is not.
That's why. The narrator probably just read it the way he read it.
Either way, but I hear a majority of people say Unruh, so that's what I'm going with for this episode.
Okay.
So you get ready to get started then?
Okay. Eth.
So is this now going to be the ASMR section of Macabre Emporium podcast now? This is good. Nope, surprise. This is going to turn into an ASMR episode.
No, this is going to turn into fucking Delilah. Where she talks like this.
Right.
Because it's nighttime.
All right.
Nighttime sounds.
But some people might be saying, David, where's On This Day? Well, here's the truth about On This Day for May 1st. May 1st is actually quite boring except for one fact that I came across.
Well, what is it? Just throw it in as a fun fact.
So on this day in 1967, Elvis and Priscilla get married.
Oh.
They would actually have a 5-foot-tall wedding cake that costs $3,200 in 1967. Like $3,100, sorry. In 1967. And of course, I hit that inflation calculator button and it came out to be like 30 grand today in 2024.
Cakes are stupid, dude.
Oh, I know, especially wedding cakes. But guess what song they danced to for their, you know, the traditional first dance?
Oh, Is it an Elvis? Is it an Elvis song?
Yep.
Love Me Tender.
Yep.
Figures.
I don't know how I feel about that. It's like you couldn't pick another song, but you're Elvis. You're the king of rock and roll. So, but anyway, now we can really get started.
Okay.
The late George Carlin had a bit about phrases, and one I mentioned in a previous episode is the quiet ones you always have to watch out for. Also, you know, I like to look up the origins and the first of things as well. This week, I am bringing true crime that fits the bill as what's considered as the first mass murder. But as terminology and phrases are coined, this is more of a case of America's first active shooter.
Okay.
So what counts as a mass shooting and an active shooter? According to the FBI's website, their definition of an active shooter is an individual actively engaged in killing or attempting to kill people in a populated area. A mass shooting is a violent crime in which one or more attackers kill or injure multiple individuals simultaneously using a firearm.
Okay.
So Howard Unruh fits the first one.
Okay.
There is no widely accepted definition of mass shooting, and different organizations tracking such incidences use different definitions, even though the Investigative Assistance for Violent Crimes Act of 2012 defines mass killings as three or more killings in a single incident. Howard Unruh was born on January 21, 1921, in East Camden, New Jersey, to Samuel Shipley Unruh and Frieda E. Vollmer. He had a single younger sibling named James. His mother raised them both, and his parents separated when he was 9 years old. His father worked for the American Dredging Company, so his father would be gone for weeks at a time.
Dredging?
Yep, like dredging rivers and whatnot.
Yeah.
But this is probably more like dredging harbors, larger bodies of water, probably still rivers too.
Oh, you think the Hudson?
Maybe. Probably.
If he's out in that
area. Yep, East Camden, New Jersey area, I'm sure probably.
Yeah.
One psychiatrist noted that Unruh had delayed developmental skills when he didn't walk or talk until he was 16 months old, whereas most children are doing both of these by 12 months. The broken home found in most backgrounds of mass shooters or serial killers wasn't present either in Unruh's life. Whenever his parents disciplined him, he was either sent to his room or told to sit in a chair. They didn't seem to use any other type of corporal punishment like spankings. Even when his brother was born in 1924, he didn't show any signs of sibling rivalry or resentment for his brother being born and not being the only child anymore.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that tend to happen in between siblings. Mm-hmm. He attended high school in East Camden and graduated from Woodrow Wilson High School in 1939. He was a pretty average student, getting mostly B's and C's from one of the report cards that you can see online. So next to his senior photo, his senior quote is, "How is a quiet fellow, despite his apparently shy demeanor, how has made a getty many friends with his fellow members of the practical arts course. Howe's main ambition is to become a government employee, and if his previous work is any indication, the position is good as filled." So from what that sounds like to me, Howard Unruh was like always well-to-do, you know, straight and narrow. That's his, you know, dots his T's, cross his I's kind of guy.
Dots his T's, cross his I's.
And to throw that in there to see how well you're paying attention.
Oh, I'm paying attention. That was funny.
His yearbook also stated that one of his favorite songs was Get Out and Get Under the Moon by Helen Kane. Unruh's main hobbies included stamp collecting and model trains.
Oh.
Oh, shit. We better watch out here.
I better watch out. There's a serial killer sitting across the table from me.
And it's funny, before I trimmed my beard, and you know, after I trimmed my beard up on the ladies I work with, she mentioned this, like, "Oh, you were starting to look like a serial killer." My first thought was like, "No, you have no idea what they look like, and 99% of them are all clean cut and normal looking dudes." I was reaching the...
But you toss those glasses on that you have?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm just kidding.
I was reaching more the nutball in the wood sending out packages territory is where I was going. Ted Kaczynski.
Oh, yeah.
So, with him doing model trains, I did the extra work since I figured you would ask this question. It was more than likely O or S scale due to HO scale that you know I have models of wasn't around until the late 50s and early 60s.
We love the HO scale.
And, of course, she didn't actually ask me that question because she probably didn't think of it. But I didn't. Like, I figured, you know what? I put it in here. I'm telling them anyway.
It probably would have been one of those after the fact, like,
mm-hmm.
What gauge did he run?
Right. And I know somebody else is going to probably, that listens to this, probably would send me a message and ask me if I found that answer out.
Kevin?
Yep. Besides model trains and stamp collecting, he would often read his Bible and attend church on a regular basis. After graduation, Unruh held a few jobs. He worked in the printing. He worked in printing at the Acorn Company and worked in metal stamping at Bud Manufacturing, which was probably great for his modeling as the Bud Company was a leading manufacturer of stainless steel passenger cars up until 1987.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Now, probably with that, I don't know how much freelance kit bashing there was done in those times like there is now. It's a good possibility that they were still doing such things back then. I wouldn't know. But even if they were working there, you know, hey, you're seeing you get the full drawing, real world drawings in front of you. He enlisted into the army in October of 1942 during World War II and saw combat in France, Italy, Belgium, and the European theater between October 1944 and July 1945. So he wasn't enlisted. He volunteered because when he was working these various jobs, he would see the sailors coming in off the boat and was very impressed by that. So he decided to join the military. But why would you join the army if you're being oppressed by these seamen? You know, Sarah's 12-year-old kicked in when I said that. No,
that's because Ginger was about to slide off and she did exactly what I thought she was going to.
Come. He was even in the Battle of the Bulge, which could also be known as Hitler's Last Stand.
Oh.
He was assigned to the 332nd Field Artillery Unit, part of General Patton's 3rd Army. He was a crewman for an M7 mobile artillery piece known as the Priest because the British soldiers said this thing looked like a priest's pulpit inside of a church way it was designed. He was remembered by his section. God damn it. Here we go. It's episode 3 all over again.
Nothing will beat you. It's just out of nowhere. Tits. Oh, man.
He was remembered by his section chief, Norman E. Cohen, as a good soldier who never swore, drank, or chased girls when on leave. Which they probably found this a little bit weird in those times because General Patton was known to say, if they don't fuck, they don't fight. So they probably, kind of think quickly, General Patton almost could be considered alpha male status.
Ah, okay.
For those times, but you got to think in the 1940s, that was a whole lot of the things as, oh, you're not a real man if you're not chasing women, smoking cigarettes and all this stuff. But
got to get your dick wet.
Yeah, pretty much. So instead of using some of the brothels in Italy and France that were either pre-established or established by commanding officers with the whole if they don't fuck, they don't fight mentality to keep that up because of testosterone levels and whatnot, he would actually spend his time reading his Bible and writing letters home to his mother.
That's a little hypocritical, right?
What?
That he was the one that came up with, if they don't fuck, they don't fight?
No, that was General Patton, not Howard Unruh.
Oh, okay. Sorry. My brain didn't switch there.
So, like I said, he would, instead of chasing after women and using brothels and getting shit-faced drunk in Europe, he was writing letters home to his mother. He was reading his Bible instead. Even though considered almost a model soldier, being a steady shot and unrattled in combat, he did have a slight quirk about him during his time in Europe.
And what's that?
Unruh would keep a very detailed journal of the Axis soldiers he killed. He kept notes on the time, date, and place of his kills. He would even sometimes write a description of how the bodies looked in death. He would be honorably discharged in 1945, even earning the European Theater of Operations Medal, Victory Medal, and the Good Conduct Medal, which, from what I understand, you know, cross-referencing with other hosts, like, this is the 3 medals like everybody earned in World War II, no matter what. Either way, still earned them because, you know, fought in combat.
Their participation ribbon.
Basically is what they recalled them as, basically.
Yeah. I was smirking at her paw just...
No
way. Like she's over there in a rave of her own.
It's cat. Pretty much. After he is discharged, he would return to East Camden, New Jersey, where his younger brother has moved out and gotten married. And Unruh ends up living with his mother from here. He ended up taking another job in sheet metal work, as he did before the war, but this wouldn't last long, and he would end up using his GI Bill to attend Temple University to become a pharmacist. His time at Temple would last only about 3 months before dropping out, which I couldn't find a definitive answer on what it was.
Okay.
He would start to become more of a recluse, spending time reading his Bible in his room, surrounded by spoils of war, being ashtrays and machetes made from the shell casings from the M7 Priest artillery rounds, and that he was a crewman of. The medals he earned, and instead of trying to find work, he pretty much was living off the income that his mother was making from the low-paying job at a soap company she's working at. When Howard Unruh would become tired of his trains or his stamps, he would spend hours in his homemade shooting range in the basement of his mother's home, firing a .08 9mm Luger pistol he bought in a pawn shop for $37.50, or $492 in today's money.
That's crazy.
So the thing about these .08 9mm Luger pistols is that in World War II, they were used specifically by German officers, so it's probably somebody brought back from World War II, and he couldn't get his hands on one himself, so this now he's buying one. So now, you know, so it's another one of those relics, not relics, you know, trophy things from fighting in World War II that he wanted.
Okay.
So here he would end up practicing shooting either in a kneeling or prone position in the shooting range she's made in the basement of his mother's home.
And what is prone position?
Prone position is basically laying on your stomach.
Okay.
And this is due because of the ceiling being so low in there. But some of this behavior can be attributed to battle fatigue, or as we know it now today as PTSD.
Okay.
It was also known as shell shock at one point.
Yeah.
He did date a girl from his Bible study group for about 2 years and abruptly ended their relationship by telling her he was schizo and had no plans of getting married. During their entire relationship, he never attempted to hold her hand or give her a case of the clap of any sort. No. He never attempted to hold her hand or give her a kiss of any sort, is what I have written down. I'm just leaving all this stupid shit in because...
You need to.
Just because this is the first episode back after almost a fucking month. His neighbors would say he was stiffly formal and not friendly, but harmless. The type of guy that wouldn't hurt a flea. As time went on, Unruh became paranoid that his neighbors were talking about him behind his back, calling him a mama's boy and a queer.
I mean, fair enough.
The truth is, Howard Unruh was gay, and due to laws at the time, you could face lengthy jail time for being caught with another man. He would make several trips a week to Philadelphia to hook up with other men. Like this time in Europe during the war, he would keep a diary of his hookups. Some of his partners would be listed by first name and others just listed as a man.
So that's why he never chased the women.
Mm-hmm. He would keep a third diary as he would become more paranoid. This one would be a list of grievances against his neighbors. Maurice Cohen and his wife Rose, a pharmacist next door he held a grudge against, is the most as they complained repeatedly about Unruh's habit of listening to the radio at all hours at high volume. But this also could have been in retaliation of the Cohen son Charles, was free to aggravate Howard Unruh with his trumpet playing. Even though the Cohens did the neighborly thing and allowed him and his mother to use their back gate to access their street, their complaints with Howard were that he was constantly leaving it open, which would allow the neighborhood stray dogs of the Kramer Hill neighborhood of East Camden to come in and eat their garbage. This situation would become so tense between the Unruhs and the Cohens that his mother would hire a local handyman to install a separate gate for Howard to use instead. Unruh would also make claims that Maurice shortchanged him at least 5 times when making purchases at the drugstore that the Cohens owned. Other neighbors Unruh had listed in his diary, the grievances he had against them. Thomas Segrino, a tailor, Unruh believed he was spreading rumors about his sexuality. The couple that lived below him threw trash in the back of his lot. Clark Hoover, a barber, would put dirt from the construction project in the vacant lot, causing the drainage to back up and flood the basement, which means he can't go down there and shoot his pistol.
Oh, yeah. We're just kind of screwed up that they're doing that to sabotage. I mean, that's his mom's house. It's not his house. Yes, he's living there.
Right.
But that is his mother's home.
Right. But, you know, he's probably thinking it's just dirt. It's whatever. And it's an open lot. You know, there's probably a lot more detailed stuff into it that goes to that. But just what I could find. John Filichek, a cobbler, or also known as a shoemaker, would bury his trash close to the property. And a boy by the name of Carl Sorg tapped into his electricity to run lights for the Christmas trees he was selling. Next to some of the people listed in this diary, he had initials next to their names, either RWTS or DNDR, meaning retaliate when time suitable and do not delay retaliation.
Oh, so he had a priority list.
Yep. And probably I would have changed this if somebody would have called him back apologizing so he can lay back on his couch, cross it off lipstick, and put it on himself. Billy Madison.
I don't remember that, but that's funny.
He called, towards the end of the movie, he calls Steve Buscemi's character in the movie, you know, apologizing for bullying him through high school. So Steve Buscemi's character crosses his name off a list of people to kill, and he puts it on later. And then later, towards the end, he saves Billy Madison's life. Don't remember that part?
Nope.
Okay, anyway. On the evening of September 5th, 1945, Howard was to meet with a lover he was already having weeks-long affairs with at the Family Theater in Philadelphia, which was a well-known meet-up spot for men, but traffic kept him from arriving on time and his date had left by the time he had arrived. Unruh would sit through three showings of the double feature of I Cheated the Law and The Ladies' Gambles before he would return home after 3 a.m. Feeling rejected, here he would discover the newly constructed gate his mother had installed for him had been ripped from the hinges. Thinking that this was some type of retaliation from the Coens, this very well could have been the last straw for Howard Unruh, as the gate was actually vandalized by some neighborhood boys. But he was not aware of this.
Uh-huh.
He would lay in bed awake for the rest of the evening, stewing in his rage after finding the broken gate that he believed this was done by the Coens. The following morning, after Unruh showered, shaved, and put on his best suit after finishing a breakfast of fried eggs and cereal, Howard then goes to the basement to retrieve a piece of lead pipe he had stashed away to deal with Carl Sorg if he had ever returned to steal his electricity to run his lights. He summoned his mother to the living room of their apartment, posed as if he was intended to hit her. She would ask, "Why would you want to do that, Howard?" She would flee the house in terror and before he could act. He would then go to his bedroom and retrieve his prized .08 9mm Luger, an extra magazine, and 30 loose rounds, and exited the apartment around 9:20 a.m. and out onto River Road. He first shot at the driver of a bread truck, shoving his pistol through the door, but missed him by inches. This unknown driver failed to warn the residents of Kramer Hill of Unruh's actions. His next stop was the cobbler, John Filatrek. He entered the store where Filatrek was busy installing new soles to a pair of shoes, and without a word, undershot John twice, once in the stomach and once in the head.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, it ramps up from there.
Oh, I'm sure.
Here he then goes to the barbershop of Clark Hoover, where he is busy cutting the hair of 6-year-old boy named Orris Smith. Unruh would tell Hoover, "I got something for you, Clarky," as he steps towards the white carousel horse child's chair and shoots Clark and Orris, striking Clark in the head and Smith in the neck, killing them both. Or Smith's mother screamed in horror, rushing toward the pair while Unruh calmly exited the barbershop and continuing with his walk in death.
So wait, he killed the little boy too?
Yep.
Damn. What'd the little boy do?
Just innocent bystander.
Ugh.
Dominic Lloyd, a restaurant owner next door to the barbershop, heard the shooting and the screaming and running in and seeing, you know, his mother grabbing his body, and he would end up trying to do the right thing and save Orris by taking him to the hospital, but he was dead before they even got out of the barbershop. And Orris Smith was getting his haircut for the first day of school the next day.
Maybe I didn't need my emotional support kit after all.
No, we're not done yet.
Oh, great.
From here, he would proceed to Cohen's drugstore. Maurice Cohen ran out moments after hearing the shooting and started shouting, "What's going on here?" As he spotted Unruh wielding his pistol, turned and ran back inside. James Hutton, an insurance agent for the neighborhood, including the Unruh family, ends up blocking the doorway to see what's causing the unfolding chaos of River Avenue. "Excuse me, sir," Unruh would ask Hutton. Not moving instantly for Unruh, James Hutton is shot in the head and chest, and Unruh calmly enters the drugstore, stepping over James Hutton's body. By the time, Maurice has made it upstairs to their apartment, warning them of Unruh's actions and to hide. His wife, Rose, would scream to their son to go hide, which Charles would quickly hide in a closet, and his mother would take shelter in another one as well. Unruh spots Maurice trying to escape across the rooftop through a window, shooting him in the back, and Maurice falls and dies on the sidewalk below. Hearing Rose's cries from a closet, Unruh shoots through the door three times, then opens it and shoots 38-year-old Rose in the face. Meanwhile, 63-year-old Minnie Cohen, Maurice's mother, is trying to call the police, and Howard Unruh finds her and shoots her in the head and chest, and heads back downstairs and back onto River Avenue. 12-year-old Charles Cohen survives by hiding in this closet his mother puts him in. While crossing the street to his next target, Thomas DeGrino, a sedan driven by a World War II veteran and television repairman, 24-year-old Alvin Day slowed down by spotting the body of James Hutton laid out on the sidewalk. Choosing to turn around before he could escape, Unruh walked up to the driver's side of Day's sedan and shot him in the head through the window, sending his car careening onto the sidewalk. Men watched from a bar across the street as Unruh continued his walk. He would take shots at them and the men dove back inside. Next door, 2-year-old Tommy Hamilton looks outside a window while he's playing with the curtains and is shot and killed by Unruh. Tommy's caretaker, Irene Race, would collapse in severe shock witnessing little Tommy being shot. Thomas Agrino was out of the shop at the time Howard Unruh entered, but his wife, 28-year-old Helga, was there. She pleaded for his life as he shot her in the store. Even not on his list, he decided to kill a manager of the corner grocery, Earl Horner. Luckily, he had locked the door after a group of children that had ran past Unruh during the initial shooting ran in to find shelter from the rain of bullets unleashed by Unruh. Unable to get inside, he still fired shots at the door as those inside hid behind a counter, unarmed.
Damn.
During his walk, one of the articles that I did read that was archived, they said that these children were screaming, crazy man, as he ran past him. He didn't even acknowledge their existence at this point.
So he was just fucking out of it.
He was out of it. He was seeing red basically from a gate being destroyed that wasn't even destroyed by the people he thought that did it.
So is this kind of like the one movie that you made me watch?
This is what I thought that was based off of, but I cannot find anything what that movie is based off of. Any true events that the movie we're speaking of is called Falling Down with Michael Douglas. Yes, really that. Good movie. I didn't make you watch. You seemed interested, but anyway.
Well, I had never seen it before, so yeah, we watched it. You didn't force me to watch right. it.
You would think that his character that goes by the name of Defense, because that was his license plate, would be based on these events, but
it just sounds similar.
Right. 18-year-old Charlie Peterson and two friends happened to turn onto River Avenue unaware of what was going on. Unruh would spot the trio, taking aim at the three boys and hitting Charlie Peterson in the arm after they had stopped and stared at the body of James Hutton on the sidewalk. Charlie would survive his injuries. He spotted an approaching car as he turned to head away from the grocery. 37-year-old Helen Wilson, her mother, 68-year-old Emma Metlack, and Helen's son, 9-year-old John Wilson. Unruh would shoot into the windshield 3 times, killing Helen and Emma instantly. John survived and died 18 hours later in Cooper Hospital.
Damn.
From here, he would go to the home of Madeline Harris. Even though not on the list, he would shoot at her 3 times, hitting her in the arm, and two of the shots would miss. She was at home with her 2 sons, Armand and Leroy. Her 16-year-old son, Armand, would defend his mother, but be struck down and shot twice by Unruh in the arm, aiming at his chest and goes to fire, and Armand, but his Luger is empty. He left as fast as he entered their home, digging into his pocket for more ammunition, but he was out. Here, he would be shot in the butt by bar owner Frank Engel. They got his pistol and shot at Unruh from his apartment window. Engel recalled that Unruh seemed to be unnerved by being shot. After 12 minutes, from the first shot rang out to the police starting to swarm into Cannon Hills neighborhood to River Avenue, Unruh would return home and barricade himself in his apartment. In 12 minutes, Howard Unruh would shoot and kill 12 people and injure 3.
Wow.
And he did this with 1 pistol.
How many rounds did he have?
He had, the extra work I didn't do.
You wrote how many extras.
But I don't know off the top of my head how much each magazine holds.
Okay. So it was magazines that you said, not actual bullets. Okay.
No, he put 30 round loose rounds in his pocket.
That's.
But I don't know how many rounds are in each magazine for a Luger. Detective William Kelly Sr. was the first officer to respond to the 911 calls and would end up in a shootout with the now barricaded Unruh. In the midst of the gunfight, journalist Philip Buxton of the Camden Evening Courier located Unruh's number and called him up.
Is this Howard?
Yes. What's the name of the party you want?
Unruh.
What's the name of the last name of the party you want?
Unruh, I'm a friend, and I want to know what they're doing to you.
They're not doing a damn thing to me, but I'm doing plenty to them.
How many people have you killed?
I don't know yet, because I haven't counted them. But it looks like a pretty good score.
Why are you killing people?
I don't know. I can't answer that yet. I'm too busy. I'll have to talk to you later. A couple of friends are coming over to get me.
So that was this whole phone conversation that that this news reporter had with Howard Unruh shortly after this all happened. The police were finally able to get Unruh to surrender after smoking him out of his apartment with tear gas. Charles Hance and Captain Everett Joslin stormed up the stairs to Unruh's apartment, shouting to come down with your hands up. Where Unruh would tell them, "I give up, don't shoot." He emerged from the apartment and fell at the feet of the two officers. Now, I don't know if this is because that's because being clumsy, the gas, or he's blood loss from being shot, because he's not aware he's even been shot.
Huh. Well, his adrenaline's running so right. High.
Yeah, and that too, you're not going to feel it because it's like, oh, it's like you see it in movies, you know, like action sequences. It's like, oh, so-and-so, you've been shot. Oh, yeah, I guess I have been, you know.
Once that adrenaline wears off, I'm sure it'll be different.
Right. When they searched his apartment, they found an arsenal of knives and guns and an ammo press, which isn't really that weird thing because a lot of people that own firearms, some of them do reload their own shells and casings and whatnot because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. They like doing it, whatever. They would end up finding 700 rounds he had been making. Now, this, they never specified if it's just rounds in general for all of his firearms or this one specific gun. I'm going to assume he had more than one type, but you know that P.O.8 Luger was his favorite because it was his prize gun from World War II. And of course, his war trophies he had brought home. And they also found the shooting range. But on the table of his bedroom, they would find books on sex hygiene. And they noted that his Bible was open to Matthew chapter 24, which is a chapter of the Bible where Jesus predicts the destruction of a temple and end times.
Okay.
Now, he wasn't any kind of doomsday prophecy thing or whatnot. This was a shooting, you know, because he snapped.
Okay.
You know, that because it was like, God spoke to me and I need to go, kill as many as people. He's akin to ushering the apocalypse. This was basically because he just lost his shit because over a broken gate and he was paranoid.
Gotcha.
At least that's my opinion on what I gathered from looking into this. But also in this chapter, Jesus would also warn his disciples they always need to be spiritually ready for his return in the middle of his investigations after he's given them these very meticulous, well-detailed, you know, testimony, whatever we want to call it right now. This is where they would finally figure out he's been shot.
It took that long?
Yep. So maybe he didn't bleed out that much after all, but they probably would have hit like an artery in his leg or whatnot.
Oh, well, they would have known that.
Right. They like some places said it was his butt. Some places said it was his thigh, upper thigh. But who knows?
So with that, he was fully aware of what he was doing while
fully aware of what he was doing the entire time.
Okay.
And he would actually end up being in the same hospital where one of his victims, 9-year-old John Wilson, was fighting for his life after, you know, before he died 18 hours later from shooting him. Unfortunately for the victims, he would be found mentally unfit to stand trial for 13 counts of murder and 3 counts of atrocious assault.
Atrocious assault.
Yep. Old timey law.
I was gonna say, I don't think I've ever heard that as, a charge.
He would be diagnosed eventually with paranoid schizophrenia by a psychologist. He would be sent to live in New Jersey Hospital for the Insane, where he would be put in the private cell in the room building that was for maximum security patients, where he would be known as case number 47077. He would never stand trial for his crimes, even though every year he would be reevaluated to see if he was mentally competent with treatment. Murder is a sin. I should get the chair, he would tell the doctors during their sessions. He did claim to feel sorrow for killing children, but doctors noted that he didn't seem remorseful for his actions. There are a lot of other things I have found that allegedly Unruh had said due to having narcosynthesis administered, also known as truth serum, but scientists discredited this drug being effective in the 1950s due to patients molding truth and fiction together. Now, with that being said, some of the other things that I did find is that he made claims that he laid in bed with his mother, and when he told the doctors, it wasn't anything like actual sex that he did with his mother, but like got all touchy-feely with
heavy petting.
Yeah, the term heavy petting. We'll throw that in there with it.
Gross.
And he also made claims that he made advances on his brother and his brother refused those. But, like, the scientists said they discredited truth serum, so who knows if that was real or if it was not. While here, he never spoke much about his actions and declined an interview in 1999 with the LA Times. One of the hospital staff did befriend him, Harry Rozzle. He said that UNRWA was aware of what he did was 100% wrong, and he is sorry that he did it. He was even aware of the anniversary every year of his shooting spree, but correct term of the day, his active shooting spree. In 1992, Charles Cohen, the boy that survived in the closet, interviewed by the LA Times about the shooting spree, was still bitter and angry about losing, you know, his parents and his grandmother on September 6th, 1949.
Well, fuck yeah, dude.
And he said, "I don't want anyone to see him as a poor old man. He's a mass killer that has outlived most of the families that he destroyed. I'm just waiting for the call that he's dead and I'll spit on his grave and that will be it." Unfortunately, Charles Cohen did not get his fantasy of his to take revenge on UNRWA as he would die on September 4th in the year 2000. To year 2009. 2 days before the 60th anniversary, which I'm sure would open the wounds once again more. However, he was spared of having to see and hear the news of his granddaughter's high school under siege by another like Howard UNRWA at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, 69 years later.
Jeez. Oh,
where she would survive that mass shooting just as her grandfather did by hiding in a closet.
History repeating itself.
Yep. Howard UNRWA would finally stop wasting our precious air on October 19th, 2009, dying at the age of 88 of an extended illness that I couldn't find more details on. His last words would be, "I'd kill thousands if I had enough bullets." Now, could he have said that even if it was because he knew what he was doing was wrong, or on his deathbed being delusional because people start seeing weird shit when then, you know, they're on their deathbed, but I highly doubt that.
No, that's pretty fucking very precise to what he did.
Very specific on your deathbed to be saying that.
Right.
But that is Howard UNRWA. Considered to be the father of mass shooting in the United States.
I can't really say. I've never heard that before.
I think we've talked about him before at some point, but really didn't know him. I know he was on one of the cards of Killers of the Card Game we talk about from time to time.
Uh-huh.
I know he was on one of those cards.
Huh. That was very interesting. And yes, it did go from 0 to 60 very, very quickly.
It's like I've told some other people that don't even listen to us to ask about our podcast is like you go for the serial killers and one-off murders or whatnot. And I like putting together the mass shootings and active shooters on, you know, the building the timeline and everything and whatnot.
Yeah, you're good at that. Good job, babe.
Thanks. Yeah. Pretty good episode to come back in with a bang in March, huh? Of course, I had to make some kind of stupid pun joke in there.
And of course.
A dark one at that for what this episode subject was.
Yep. You're good at that, too.
So, yeah, like I said, Facebook group, you know, that's where we post pictures of this stuff. If you're listening on YouTube, then don't worry about that.
Also, if you haven't joined the Facebook group, you really should, because that's where we post, you know, if we're not going to have an episode that week or, you know, if we have to take a break due to emergency, like that's where it will be posted.
Yep.
That way you can be up to date and know beforehand instead of showing up when our episodes drop and being like, where the fuck is it?
Right.
Facebook will tell you.
Yeah. And then also that Wednesdays and Thursday nights, we are dedicated Twitch nights. It's Wednesday night co-op or Jackbox Party Packs.
Yep.
On Wednesday with everybody in the chat, or Thursday night, it's on the or Thursday night, me playing some random game. I feel like it seems like everybody has really enjoyed watching me play Supermarket Simulator, Big Ambitions, like all those weird management games. Because it's like I let them make choices on certain things, and then every once in a while, I throw in one of those choose your own adventure horror games, kind of like The Quarry I did, and then The Devil in Me. That was a fun one. Because that was based off of H.H. Holmes' Murder Castle. We made fun of certain things in that game, too. Like, they called Lake Michigan. They talked about Lake Michigan at one point, and then in a couple dialogue lines later, they're talking about getting a panning shot over the ocean. Oh, yeah.
Huh.
So, yeah, Wednesday and Thursday, they're a fun time to have. And any other day of the week, it's a pop-up, depending on when we get stuff done for the podcast.
Yep.
So, with all that said, you're... I think it's time we close the Emporium up for the day, Sarah. What do you think?
I agree. I'm very tired.
Yep. So until next time.
Remember to creep it real. Also, just to throw it in. Today is my mama's birthday in heaven. So go hug your moms.
Yeah, go do that.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Please go and check out our website at macabreemporiumpodcast.com. Join our Facebook group by searching Macabre Emporium. Like and subscribe on YouTube at Macabre Emporium Podcast. Follow us on TikTok at Macabre Emporium Pod. Follow us on Twitter at Macabre Emporium. If you have any stories of the paranormal, your local true crime, or weird history that you would like us to look into and possibly do an episode on, email us at macabreemporiumpod@gmail.com. And remember to follow, rate, review, and share whenever and wherever you can to help us grow our podcast.